Chapter 3. Occupational Hazards. There's a monster living under my bed, whispering in my ear. There's an angel with a hand on my head. She says I've got nothing to fear. Put Your Lights On by Santana featuring Everlast. Not only was Michelle not going to shut up, she decided to occupy her own hijacked occupation, showing up at one canceled venue after another. Santa Cruz, California, March 28, 2013. Michelle shows up at Moe's Alley dressed in white coveralls, a painter's mask, and sunglasses. There is tape over her mouth, and it reads, "Silenced by fear." Her handmade signs say, "Does speech scare you that much? Have you had some distorted perceptions lately?" She refuses to speak. Instead, she communicates on a whiteboard, offering to jam with the band taking her place. After Moe's club owner refuses, she gestures angrily toward the band and shows the word "scabs" to a nearby videographer. The band, Fruity Flavors, is baffled at the accusation and continues to load in without conversation. Michelle sits down outside and strums her guitar. The occupation begins. The picture was floated on Twitter soon after, and a new flurry of demands for apologies were generated. Instead, she frustrated them further by talking about content theft and free speech, apologizing only by saying, "I'm sorry I confounded you." About a month after Yoshi's, she called up her friend Justin and suggested a little adventure. She was going to occupy her own tour and wanted him to come along to videotape. Was he game? Yeah, he was game. Davis and Winters, California, April 24, 2013. The first stop was K-Dirt Public Radio on the UC Davis campus in Davis, California. It was April 24, 2013. The show was Rod Mosenko's The Grapevine. The People's Republic of Davis is about as cooperative and politically correct as a town can get. Organic farms, retrofitted double-decker buses, light pollution ordinances, bike paths everywhere. Even the new Target has low-flush toilets and about 1,000 parking spaces for electric cars. This is a town where I once asked a policeman for directions, and he pointed me to the Karma Dome. But don't be fooled. It's also the place where the pepper spray cop meme began. Davis is not an easy mark for a protester. K-Dirt had known Michelle was coming, but not exactly when, so they were thrown off a bit in the beginning. The station manager was afraid to let her talk live, and there was quite a bit of back and forth, but ultimately they decided to stick to their public radio ideals and trusted her to go on air. No delays, no edits. If Michelle was pitching curveballs, Rod Mosenko was knocking them out of the park. Rod is the kind of guy you want around in a crisis. He wasn't intimidated by Michelle's Christian stance, didn't seem too concerned about her sex life, and he was willing to give her the time she needed to explain what she was thinking. Mostly, he was curious about why she had chosen to come to a low-powered public radio station to speak. She explained that this was exactly the kind of place where she wanted to talk. She said, "If you want to see if someone has hate in their heart, a quick glance into their eyes and you will see if there is peace in their spirit or not. And I am off balance. I'm not in a comfortable place right now, but I'm coming from a place of faith. And my faith is that all of this that's taken place has a purpose. And whether the purpose is to expose a cancer that's in our culture right now, or whether the purpose is to encourage us to do a better job of listening to each other, I don't know. But I do want to tell you that although I'm uncomfortable, I'm not afraid." He asked her if she'd had any anticipation that she was going to say anything that would create such controversy. She replied, "No. All I had the sense of was the frame that I'd created, which I've not seen represented in the media. I offered the audience a choice of truth and reality, and they chose truth. And when they chose truth, I just sang. I didn't talk. And when I came out for the encore, they sent me a tweet that said, 'Reality could include some gospel.'" So this kind of got kicked into notoriety by a tweet? By a tweet. She talked about a couple of surprises she'd had. One was the very strong reaction when she spoke about her faith. And the other was the fact that even after 25 years of sweat equity, when the big lie was told by reality media, there hadn't been more trust. There was this idea, she said, that I had gone over to the dark side. She didn't really blame people, though. She said, "Given the tenor of the times we live in, there's just so much volatility that it's crackling. The air is crackling with fear." Rod suggested that in the past, maybe her music would have been enough, that it would have spoken for her, but now she was going to have to talk, and people were going to have to listen. Michelle agreed and addressed the audience with a simple request. Intensely serious, she leaned into the microphone and said, "Please give me a chance to create healing and understanding from what's been a very big misunderstanding." The next stop was the Palms Playhouse in the sleepy little town of Winters. Winters lies at the western edge of the valley, so it's flat, but drive a couple more miles and you're twisting around in the Berryessa Gap. The Palms had not hired another band to replace her. In fact, the place was shuttered for the night, so she was able to set up right outside the front door. It was a weeknight, and the few people who were out on the street smiled politely and wondered about this odd busker who didn't have a hat out for money. And then something very special happened. A family of three who were having dinner across the street stopped by to listen. They had heard about the incident at Yoshi's and even about her protest in Santa Cruz. She explained that her audience had asked for the gospel, and she hadn't held back. They stayed for the last four songs of the set, and then they left her with a gift. They joined hands and asked God to protect her and help her tell her story. Portland, Oregon, April 25, 2013. Fueled up and ready to fight, the dynamic duo headed north to a very different scene, a canceled show at the Alberta Rose Theater. First, though, they stopped at KBOO Public Radio to talk with their old friend Brian Cutane and co-host Daniel Fleasis. Again, people who previously would have been overjoyed to see her were now suspicious and tense. But again, simply putting a face on the creature that had been created by the media was all that was needed. The interview with Daniel Fleasis of The Outside World was broadcast a few days later on April 30th. The topic immediately turned to Twitter. Michelle laughed, "Thanks to Twitter, reality as we know it has imploded." She introduced Daniel to her most persistent critic, Kevin Marasek, at iPad Goober, a.k.a. Anna in Your Pants, who had been consistently tweeting with a J.R. Ewing avatar since day one. Rather than take him seriously, she wrote him a little poem. "There once was an obnoxious gnat who talked from a 10-gallon hat. 'Twas hate speech," he'd cry, to which I reply, "Do you think this tweet makes me look fat?" This same kind of flippant response had been in play at Yoshi's, and people don't always get Michelle's sense of humor. More than once, she's been met with what she calls the sound of confound. She said, "They know me, they love me, and something has just come out of my mouth that flies in the face of everything they expected, understood, or even believed about me, and they cannot reconcile where this is coming from. So a lot of people have challenged my mental health, but let me tell you, One in five people are said to be emotionally mature, and I'm not one of them. Another tweet from Mick Ring asked if Michelle was okay. He said, "We worry." And Daniel said it sounded like there was love in that comment. Michelle responded, "Yes, but I am a feminist, and I really take issue with how any time an uppity woman speaks out and doesn't conform to polite standards of conduct, that is the default position for women, and it has been astonishing to me that women, of all people, have joined in with the mob mentality to label me crazy just because they're confounded." She continued, "It's not the artist's job to explain. It is an audience's job to understand." Daniel suggested that maybe she was asking too much from her audience, asking them to get her message. But she said we should never underestimate our audience. It was her audience, after all, that basically created her. She told Daniel, they said, "Just be yourself, Michelle. And now it's too late. I can't do anything else." Kevin Marasek's tweets began and ended this discussion. Michelle asked Brian to read another tweet from the current feed, and he came across this one. "Shame on K-Boo and on Brian and Daniel for giving a gay-bashing lunatic access to public airwaves." The room went silent. Michelle deferred to Daniel for a response. He was quiet for a moment and then said, "Shame on us for reading your tweet." Free speech had spoken. After K-Boo, Michelle and Justin headed over to the Alberta Rose, where she had been slated to play that night. The scene was surreal, like something out of Portlandia. The street presented a cast of characters that ranged from a middle-aged woman pushing a baby carriage to a grown man in a cowboy outfit, from a peasant-skirted bicyclist to a drunken admirer. The fire department showed up. The police showed up. Petitioners freaked out about fluoride in the water showed up. And then the marching band commenced. Michelle hadn't actually expected to be able to communicate, so she spent most of her time atop a large marching drum with a kazoo dangling from her mouth, doing what she called her tin drum routine, leading the counter-protest to synchronize with her own rhythm. Nothing says gay pride like Silver LeMay, and nothing says, "I'm not listening," like striking up the band just as reporters arrive with microphones. The venue had decided to capitalize on the canceled concert by throwing a benefit for Basic Rights Oregon. The marching band had been part of that show. Michelle said that they didn't feel hostile and that on some level they seemed to understand that they had turned on one of their own. Truth would have to wait. Tonight was street theater. Seattle, Washington, April 26, 2013. If Portland was street theater, Seattle was spotlight drama. Grabbing a few hours of sleep, the duo headed up to the next venue, Meander's Kitchen. But rather than go directly there, Michelle decided instead to stop by Village Green Perennial Nursery, the place where she had originally been invited to perform by Vera Johnson. Michelle had met Vera during her 2012 Rockupy tour, in which she dedicated a part of each performance to local people who were fighting foreclosure. Vera had come to tell her own story, and she and Michelle chatted on the ferry back from Vashon Island about a garden area Vera wanted to start using as a performance space. The biggest concern was weather. So when the concert was booked, it had been moved indoors to Meander's Kitchen. After Yoshi's, Meander's Kitchen owner, Miranda Crone, had canceled the concert and informed Vera of the fact, but Vera hadn't pressed for details. She didn't listen to the bootleg audio either. What she did do was call Michelle for clarification. Michelle, inundated with calls, hadn't responded. and Vera, not one to dive into a drama, hadn't pursued the topic. Michelle found Vera working in the nursery and asked to talk with her privately. She wanted to know why Vera and Miranda had canceled her concert, but Vera could only say that she followed Miranda's lead. Michelle explained that she had been accused at Yoshi's of two things, homophobia and hate speech. She and Vera talked at length, and then Michelle asked Vera, "Do you think I'm a homophobe?" Vera looked her straight in the eye and said no. Michelle asked, "Do you think what I said was hate speech?" Vera said, "No." Vera struggled over the decision, knowing Miranda would be upset, but assuming she would get over it. She knew there would be backlash from the community, but like Michelle, she assumed that she had earned a reputation that would ride her through any attacks. Later, she said she wished she had spent more time deciding. The show was announced on Facebook, and about 15 to 20 people showed up. Meanwhile, Miranda was hosting a fundraiser for gay youth at the venue. When she caught wind of what was going on at Vera's, she was displeased, to say the least. She was also Vera's tenant, renting a house from her that overlooked the garden. The next day, Miranda came over to talk. Her biggest complaint seemed to be with Vera going against her wishes, but eventually the talk came around to Michelle, who tried in vain to explain what she had meant at Yoshi's. Finally worn down physically and emotionally, Michelle gave over to complete frustration and yelled, "The only person who cares that it was a bootleg is me, and that's never going to change." Then she burst into tears. Miranda left. Everyone sat in stunned silence. Justin realized, for the first time, just how angry and confused people had become. And Vera agreed to be interviewed on camera. The video is difficult to watch, especially knowing what happened. Vera was mobbed by her own. Some people defended her, but many from her community piled on. Michelle said that she had thought that since Vera was a local leader, her community would support her. Instead, she became another perfect example of social media mobbing. But unlike Michelle, she did what Janice Harper suggested. She apologized. I contacted her in March 2014 and asked her how things went after Michelle left. She said, "I wish I'd sent Michelle to the intended venue. Then none of that would have happened, and I would not have been made out as such an awful person." When an entire community rushes to judgment instead of curiosity, there are casualties. People like Vera ultimately have to choose. Who can blame them when they take the apology route? Who can blame any of us for ducking and hiding when the mob shows up with pitchforks and torches? Boulder, Colorado, May 3rd, 2013. On May 3rd, Michelle headed out again, alone this time, but determined to demonstrate. Her first stop was Boulder's KGNU. The feeling, she said, was definitely hostile. Slumped on a couch in a red, white, and blue burqa, she tweeted that they weren't going to let her talk. Within 5 minutes, the station manager ushered her in for an abrupt interview. Barry Gilbert greeted her by saying, "Welcome," and then muttering that the word was kind of a stretch. He then made mention of her clothing and the sign she held. The sign said, "God hates censorship." He didn't take the bait. Instead, he asked if she was a homophobe or if she had engaged in hate speech at Yoshi's. "No," she replied. "If I had engaged in hate speech, I would be censoring me." She then turned the conversation back to censorship, bringing up the plight of Bradley now Chelsea Manning, whose whistleblowing had landed him in prison and whose election as Grand Marshal for the SF Pride Parade had just been vetoed. Barry still wasn't interested. He wanted to go back to the same two questions, claiming, "I'm not a journalist, but, okay, here's the thing. Michelle's mind is always churning, and whatever topic she's been considering will come out with seemingly no transition to what you were just talking about. You got to be able to hit the curveball, and Barry was no Rod Mosenko." Bradley Manning was out on first. Michelle jumped on the word journalist and tried to point the conversation toward Stephen Thrasher, the former voice writer named Journalist of the Year by the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association. Michelle wanted to discuss his recent article, "Hey to the Chief, the Military-Industrial Complex Conquers the Homos." Another out. By now, Barry had clearly lost interest in why Michelle might be dressed in a red, white, and blue burqa carrying a sign that said, "God hates censorship." He returned to his original questions until finally a classic fingers in the ears, "I can't hear you" moment ended the interview. Strike three came when Michelle's mention of the military-industrial complex was seamlessly followed by, "We're gonna cut it off here because you're not talking about your specific situation." You can hear the smile in her voice as Michelle responds, "We're talking about censorship," and ends the interview with a few strums on her guitar. Madison, Wisconsin, May 5th, 2013. The next stop was the Harmony Bar in Madison, Wisconsin. They had booked another band, but were kind enough to set her up at an alternate venue where she played for a small but appreciative audience of two. The next day brought her round to another public radio station, WORTFM, where Leonie Dulch asked some very direct questions and gave Michelle plenty of time to talk. The May 6th interview was titled, "No Tunes in Harmony." First off, Leonie asked if Michelle thought queer people are going to hell. "No," Michelle said. "I would even go on record as saying I think God loves queer people more than most. Why do I think that? Because they're special. I think they have to stand up against persecution. I think they have to stand up against conformity. I think they have to find a confidence in themselves that is not validated in the world around them. I think that they're vulnerable to attacks. I think they're vulnerable to prejudice. I think they're just special. They're very special people." For those who complained that Michelle took too long to get around to saying what she meant, here are the words that were too subtle for the headlines, words that came in the course of an extended conversation with someone she respected, not a 10-minute blast on a national TV show. Here, in a public radio station in Madison, Michelle found an ear for the words she wanted to say. "Please forgive me. Please forgive me for causing confusion. Please forgive me for causing hurt. Please hear the words that you've allowed me to express here today. And from this, judge that my intention was not to cause that harm, was not to cause that hurt. I realize that words have power. But please know that identifying my words with those of Fred Phelps is a misjudgment on your part. Please don't use judgment in a case where I've proven over 25 years with my actions as well as my words that I'm passionate about liberation. I just happen to also love the Big J." The irony of eloquence is that the words seem to come when fewer people are listening. The beauty of public radio is that those words are accessible for you to hear anytime you desire.